Welcome to Oh This World. This is a podcast for those inclined to take action.
In season one, we identified what each of us can do as individuals to hold our elected officials accountable in the age of coronavirus.
Now, with an election approaching, we're focused on the big picture.
For the rest of 2020, we will dedicate each month to an urgent issue facing Texas and America.
We will interview activists, thinkers, and citizens about how to engage on the biggest challenges facing the country.
And we will spotlight a book that tackles each topic head-on. I'm Antoinette Perez.
And I'm Lucas Schaefer. We're friends, engaged citizens, and activists here in Austin, Texas.
Our mission is to help Texans and people across the country build an America that leaves no one behind.
So wash your hands, grab a drink, and join us for Oh This World.
Welcome to Oh This World. I'm Antoinette Perez. I'm here with my awesome co-host who's back in his usual studio.
I'm out of the bathroom, Antoinette.
Lucas Schaefer. And ooh. Lucas, how are you on this beautiful Saturday, September 12th?
It's good. The last time we spoke, I was in a bathroom in Utah. And now
in the snow.
And now I am in my normal Austin recording spot. And people don't know this because we haven't done YouTube, but one funny thing is I record from our little home office. Antoinette, you record from a room in your house, and they have the same walls.
It's very, very similar.
Very similar paint.
Yellow so it looks walls, yeah.
Like we are in the same room, but we are in different rooms.
We're in different rooms, in different houses, in different neighborhoods, all in Austin, Texas, South Central Austin, Texas.
And I will say, I mean, the big thing for me, Antoinette, is because I was in out of town for 3 weeks and I flew on a plane.
I haven't done that in 6 months plus. Give us a little bit of a summary of how the flight was both directions, and was it nonstop?
It was nonstop. So we had some, so basically we were dog sitting for my husband's mom and hanging out in Utah where he is from. And I had some requirements. I mean, we both had some requirements for like doing it in the first place. I mean, one reason we did it was a long enough period of time that it seemed, you know, I don't want to say worth taking the risk, but like I wouldn't have done it for like a weekend. And we were also able to, you know, maintain our.
You flew there and quarantined for a couple of weeks.
Yes.
Right? We weren't out partying.
We went to the grocery store masked and stuff like that. But yeah, it was essentially just locked down in a different place. Here are my two takeaways.
Okay.
The plane. So we flew Delta. And I've been hearing good things just in general about
And Delta is not sponsoring Delta. This episode or this podcast. You must
know. But what I like about Delta is they don't do middle seats.
Yes.
So, I mean, I sat next to Greg because we're, you know, I wasn't
little good. Lovebirds. Well, that's
we weren't gonna. Technically, there was a seat between us, but
sure.
And they're strict about masks. They, you know, give you the Purell when you get on and off. It felt the plane felt fine, and I've read things about the ventilation on planes being pretty good. I mean, we did a fair amount of research before just hopping on a plane. My thing was the airport was not. Well, first of all, I thought, silly me thought, oh, maybe some of the security theater we do with taking our shoes off and all the other nonsense that's really just there to make us feel safe. I foolishly thought, oh, maybe they'll just not do any of this.
They'll just wave us through.
Well, they want to keep people socially distant. But if anything, it felt to me like because there were some fewer people flying, like the security people were even more thorough. So
lucky you,
you know, not great on the social distancing there. People in the airport, I don't know what's so hard about covering the nose. This is not rocket science.
Did you have a lot of droopy masks?
A lot of droopy, I would say there were people who were kind of leisurely eating, more leisurely eating than I would. I mean, we talk.
Lucas is like, chew and pull your mask up, people. Come on.
I mean, we talked to a doctor friend of ours beforehand who said, essentially, eat nothing, drink nothing, don't go to the bathroom.
That's great advice.
And we followed that. We followed that pretty well. I there were some sips of water, kind of.
You said quick, eat nothing, drink sips. Nothing, and don't go to the bathroom. Was that it?
On the yeah, I mean that's what okay. he suggested. Okay. Again, this is not. I don't want to be dispensing medical advice. He was just saying that's the ideal thing. And yeah, so that's what we did. The airplane wasn't great, and then my other thing is, and I said this on Twitter the other day. So on our flight out there, the flight crew was so great. They just had the perfect gentle touch for reminding people to stick with it. On the way back, they just didn't include some of those reminders.
Uh-oh.
And it wasn't like a nightmare, but it is amazing. And I feel like this is a metaphor for politics in general and leadership in general. The difference between saying, hey, guys, this is a pandemic. Everyone really needs to wear their masks and try to keep distant. And when you're exiting, please kind of everyone remain seated. You know, the difference between saying that and kind of just piecemeal, if they saw someone without a mask saying, hey, put your mask on, but not making those announcements.
Right.
It was a huge, huge difference in how everyone behaved. And I just thought, well, this is a great metaphor for our world in general, when there's just that leadership saying, hey guys, we all need to, and they really, I liked how they framed it in terms of like, hey, we need to look out for each other, you know, keep your masks on, blah, blah, blah. And they just didn't do it on the way back, not in a like lazy way. Like they were still saying to people, hey, put your masks on, blah, blah, blah. But just without that announcement and like a few reminders throughout, it was just, it felt a little more loosey-goosey.
Did you send this feedback to Delta?
I did not. Maybe I will. Maybe I'll
I think you should.
I will. I will.
My dad is actually like the ultimate consumer. He's the ultimate consumer. He will give feedback, positive, negative. He,
yes.
He had a Mac issue after many, many years of being PC at my suggestion over years. He finally invested in a Mac and then was not super satisfied with the computer. He'd gone through customer service several times and had gone in, of course, pre-pandemic, gone into the Apple store. They couldn't fix his issue. He wrote an email to Tim Cook. And Tim Cook responded the next day.
Oh my God. So, really?
Yeah.
What did like he say?
You know, that he had been avoiding getting a Mac, that, you know, his daughter had.
No,
been
what did
such
Tim Cook say?
Oh, that he was like, I'm forwarding this to my personal assistant. She will take care of you.
And did he? Did,
yeah.
Did she?
Yeah. Yeah.
Wow. That's great. I have not. My only story like that is one time Frontier. Mm-hmm. Yes.
Like also not a sponsor.
Canceled the flight while we were at the airport and made us rebook the flight. And it took me 7 months, Antoinette, to get 75% of the tickets back.
No, that's no good.
So
that's no good.
Maybe I needed to consult with your dad. But all of this is to say I would probably not make the flying a regular habit. I certainly wouldn't. And like the airports weren't like that dead either. Like,
well, I think more people are flying now than they were.
They are. And my other thing is, the holidays, I'm like, could everyone just stay home? Because it seems like it's going to be a disaster.
I'm bringing up the contacting Delta with your feedback in particular, because I think it's important for all businesses to have the pull from us, because when we have leadership lapses, we talk about the leadership lapses of our government on this podcast regularly. But as consumers, I think that this is our time. We have to demand that the right and the best safety protocols are in place and that they're maintained by everybody. Last season, we had talked about me taking my son to the dentist. And that there had been a lapse in protocol there, and I called that office. Very recently, we did not talk about this on the podcast. I did my weekly HEB grocery store run and had a checker and a bagger who were just not with it. And especially at the grocery store, my number one goal is get in, find the things they need, get out as fast as I can. And when you're gabbing with each other and you're not paying attention and then you make mistakes and then we have to stand there for longer to correct the mistakes. I went home and I called the manager and I said, you know, I've called before to say great things about your people and we are so grateful that all of you are doing this essential work and I need to give you some feedback about how your people are performing in the pandemic right now and things are slipping. So it was good. They were very receptive.
Interesting.
And I returned a week later and everything was tip top again. So not that I'm saying I was responsible for it.
I'm saying you were responsible for it.
I just think it helps for us to make sure that we are pulling on that steering wheel and righting the ship or the car.
And we've talked about this many times before, but the annoying thing to me is there's really no excuse, as far as I can tell, 6 months into or 8 months, however long we are into this never-ending fiasco, that the thing that would have really made me comfortable flying, which of course they don't do, and of course the government isn't doing, is just a rapid test beforehand.
Right.
I mean, it's not that easy to get a test, really, in an amount of time that
here we are in September, and that question that you asked where are the tests, is still the question of the day.
You know, and you hear about these, you know, 5 days, 10 days of lag time between getting the test back, and suddenly it is kind of completely irrelevant if you're if you're flying, you want to know not, you know, what was going on in your body 10 days ago. So,
well, we definitely appreciate your advice as a recent experienced flyer. And now some of us will be deciding if we're flying or driving to our next destination. The topic of our discussion today, though, the main thrust of this is...
Not that.
Well, it's not that, and that's good for us because we need to talk about those things too. We're back on our third episode of four, focusing on the book White Fragility by Robin DiAngelo. And we've got an interview coming up with Angela DeJoseph, who is an activist and multifaceted media person. We're going to hear more about her during the interview and talk about her experiences in all of those different areas with how it is that white fragility influences every day, everything that we do every single day. All I'll say is that she has infectious energy and I had a great time talking with her. So let's hear what Angela has to say. Angela, we are so excited to have you here today. As a journalist, a filmmaker, and founder of Women of Color Roar Media, you and I have had several conversations about, well, everything, activism, the representation of women of color in media. And so you were the first person that popped into my mind when Lucas and I talked about who we could bring onto the podcast to chat with us about issues of white fragility and those kinds of things. So welcome to the podcast.
Thank you so much, and congratulations on the podcast.
Thank you. You yourself have at least one podcast right now. Is that right?
Yes, I do a radio show here in San Diego, and it's also available online. So it's called Woman of Color Roar Radio. So decided to just, you know, just be consistent with the branding.
Oh, for sure. For sure. You have been one of the most active. I'm just going to insert this really quick. I met Angela when she and I both attended the She the People conference in Houston back in April 2019, before the world caught on fire fully. And many of us who were attending, those of us that were all there congregated together, were actually representatives of local indivisible groups around the country. And Angela was the only one who was there not only as an attendee, but also as like a media person. I remember you had like the press badge
That's
and everything.
Funny, yes.
And you were hustling. Tell us a little bit about that crossover between like your personal life, your professional activism, all of those kinds of things. Like it seems like you would never stop moving in a world like today.
Well, it's interesting. Having started my career, you know, as a writer and in journalism at an early age, at this point, you know, being an activist, but having the mindset of a journalist. So I'm still looking at everything and seeing certain visuals, for example. So when we were at Sheet of People, and mm-hmm. for people that don't know, that was the first time that women of color actually had their own presidential forum. Mm-hmm. And it was early. That was one of the first ones in this whole cycle. And we were in Houston, and we were at a historically black college. We were mm-hmm. at Texas Southern University. Mm-hmm. And it was an opportunity to see the presidential candidates addressing women of color. And so I was credentialed there mm-hmm. To cover it. And I got to be right up front, and I took amazing photos.
Yes.
And then, you know, and ended up writing about it for the paper. But then I was also there with Indivisible. So also me as an activist was there.
Yes.
But I think that having the critical eye, I really was able to discern what was going on with the candidates. And I was able to track them throughout the cycle to see where they were going, when they were stumbling, when they were doing well. Mm-hmm. And so I became that voice to, you know, the people in my activist community that they didn't really want to hear from. Because mm-hmm. one, being the only black leader in the Indivisible down here in San Diego. And number mm-hmm. two, not buying into their white saviors that was the first time we had a break between us.
Wow. I remember at that event, because we only had about a day together, that I learned you lived in San Diego and that Kamala Harris was your senator. And
yes.
I remember us having a powwow after the conference was over and the forum piece was over and we had heard from all of the candidates. You were the only person in our group who had experience with Kamala Harris as your senator. What were your feelings at the end of that conference after watching her speak and present, knowing that you also had, by the way, behind the scenes credentialed access to the candidates as well? How did you feel about her then? Let's start with that.
Well, it's very interesting because I knew that she had so much more to offer that day mm-hmm. that the people that were there did not get to see. Mm-hmm. For one thing, there was a question that they asked each candidate, so like, why should black women vote for you?
Yes.
Well, at that point, she should have just stood up and said, well, look at me.
Right.
So, but she didn't. And that right there let me know the people that were around her and the way she was first being very careful was not the way to go. Now, fast forward all the way to the end, her last weekend on the campaign, she was in South Carolina and they had a Black Women's Weekend with Black women and Black sorority. And she was all the way, you know, the Black woman who'd gone to Howard, and she was all the way there mm-hmm. in her most vibrant, authentic self. And when she mm-hmm. showed up, you know, even in Iowa with the drum line, and mm-hmm. that was where she needed to be and who she right. needed to be. And so that was what I saw in She the People. I'm like, okay, no, you've got to bring it. You've mm-hmm. got to bring it. And so, so I was happy to see, and it's interesting, I'll just tell you that she went this way in terms of her campaigning, and she got better and better, and she got more and more in touch, and her message got home. And Elizabeth Warren went the opposite. Mm. That day, Elizabeth Warren was great, and then Elizabeth Warren went the opposite way, which is very interesting. But that was what my friends and I—that's where we broke up, because I was backing the black woman, and they were backing the white woman. So. And that's how I saw it. They didn't see it that way, because the thing about the left and this thing about white fragility is that the people on the left have this attitude somehow that, you know, because they give a donation to, you know, the NAACP or something, and they have a black friend, and they, you know, they think they're not racist, but it's what I call inadvertent racism, because they don't realize that it's, you know, that it's microaggressions and it's their inner bias. And I'll just give you, I mean, a minor example would be something like, if my hair is straight and suddenly they decide, oh, you really look pretty that way, I like your hair that way. Well, what you're saying they don't know is that when my hair looks like your hair, it's pretty and it is acceptable. Mm-hmm. As opposed to when I wear my hair in its natural state, somehow it's not to you. But these are right. the kinds of things. And so when it came down to Kamala's record and everything about Kamala, they were willing to buy into anything that was said about her that was negative, true, not, or whatever. Anything about Elizabeth Warren, they were ready to fight about for her and didn't want to know anything that was truth. And they wanted to push back on it. And I said, well, what about the Black woman? Why? What about her? And so I had to call them out about what I saw was a bias, and the media was absolutely biased and negative towards, you know, the Black woman. And that's why her prevailing and being the vice presidential candidate is such a victory, is so satisfying, because she had it harder, more difficult, was had it even, you know, was chastised and picked on. The things that were allowed to happen to her weren't happening to the other candidates. And so wow. that's all. And that's the thing about it with Black people. We have to work twice as hard to be better, be smarter, be tougher, always have to jump through extra hoops. And I don't feel that our allies have been allies.
How did the how receptive were your white counterparts to your argument? I mean, did they see what you were saying, or was it sort of just didn't register?
No, they didn't want it to.
They didn't want it to, right?
No, they didn't want it to, because then they would have to be wrong. And right. so, for example, okay, if I showed them a picture and I would say, here's Elizabeth Warren, and there's no Black people in this, you know, in this picture, and she's uh-huh. in this town that's predominantly Black. And they would go, oh, look, there's a Black person. Oh, there's one there. And it's like, okay, yeah, there's four Black people and there's 4,000 people in this picture. You know, they didn't want to face up to the reality
right.
of it. And that's the same thing. I mean, the same thing with Bernie, you know, with Bernie people. It's like in the middle of New York, he had that, you know, that big event. And I'm like, this is Brooklyn or whatever. There's all these Black people, Brooklyn, Bronx, and Queens. And look at who's in this audience. Mm-hmm. I said, this is not going to fly.
Mm.
So I think that, you know, so that's, I think now I will tell you that now, everybody is like, Angela was right. Like, Angela, you were right, or whatever. But I have to be the one who stands up for the truth. If you're mad at me or you don't agree or whatever, it's like, and I tell them, I said, it's the same thing as activists that we do. We stand up. We stand up to power. We go against the grain, or mm-hmm. as Kamala says, we go up the rough side of the mountain. Mm-hmm. And I said, and that's what she was doing. Mm-hmm. And you all didn't stand with her. You didn't recognize it, and you didn't stand with her. And I said, and that's what I'm doing. I said, if I have to be the only one standing with the Black woman, I'm going to do it. And then it was interesting, because then, like, I have some other Kamala supporter friends, and they're like, Angela, we'll stand with you.
Oh,
so,
wow.
So it would just be me, but it really exposed, I think, the bias that was there.
Yeah.
There's a quote in the book that I was reminded of when you said that there was a divide and a split that happened between you and white progressive allies. I feel like I've mentioned this in every episode that we've done so far, but it's a big one for me. Robin DiAngelo in White Fragility says, I believe that white progressives cause the most daily damage to people of color. I define white progressives as white people who think they're not racist or are less racist, or in the choir, or already get it. White progressives can be the most difficult for people of color because to the degree that we think we have arrived, we will put our energy into making sure that others see us as having arrived. none of our energy will go into what we need to be doing for the rest of our lives. And then she goes on and lists the work of anti-racism. It is interesting to me that I don't think that you'd read the book, Angela, and you've basically just validated this entire section of the book and this entire piece of that premise, that the white progressive, without doing the hard work of internal reflection, asking the tough questions and sitting in discomfort for a while, it's not going to happen for us, is it?
No, and the other thing has to do with listening and not talking.
Mm.
And that's the thing I find with a lot of white progressives is that they have a lot to say about everything. And then when I tell them, I said, you know, I don't speak for all Black people. One of my friends asked me yesterday, you know, well, what are Black people going to do with Trump? I'm like, I don't know what Black people are going to do. I'll tell you what I'm going to do. Mm-hmm. You know, I am not the spokesperson for Black people. But I have to tell them that I've been Black my whole life, mm-hmm. and my experiences and how many Black people I know and the different kinds of Black people I know is far outweighs yours. Mm-hmm. So if I tell you something, you can probably take it to the bank. Mm-hmm. And so when I tell you that this is not going to work, and that the people that are the mainstream Democratic voter is a different pragmatic voter than the three Black people that you know that are activists, mm-hmm. because most of the people that are younger and activists are going to go more to the left and going to see the world differently. Right. I mean, I saw the world differently when I was their age, mm-hmm. but in general, when you get to a certain point and the majority of people who actually vote are more pragmatic, so there are things that are important to them are different. And that's why we have Joe Biden. That's why we don't have the other people, all of those other people, all 14 of those other people that were on the stage. We ended up, and I tell them, I said, it's your fault we have Joe Biden. It's your fault. Because you, all the other people who were more progressive, who had great ideas, who were going to do a lot of the things you wanted, you didn't want them.
Right.
So this is why you get Joe Biden.
Right.
I'm curious if, like, in after the George Floyd murder, and we had like this like mad rush of like white progressives buying all of these books, like White Fragility, How to Be an Anti-Racist, mm-hmm. you know, going into the streets perhaps for the first time, etc. Did any of that translate into white progressives in your indivisible world or in your orbit actually listening more? Or did it seem more just performative?
Well, actually, they have grown quite a bit, I will tell you, in the past year. I have seen a lot of growth. And so, you know, there are some people who just came out with Black Lives Matter for the first time. But I will say that within our progressive community, that there has been a lot of growth. San Diego doesn't have a very big Black population, but most of them, if they know Black people, it's through me. If they know anybody, it's because of me. And so, but what's happened is they've made it a point to try to pull more people in it. Because I told them, I said, I can't be your only Black friends. Mm-hmm. You got to have some other Black friends because we're all different. So now it's like, now we've got, you know, more mindset. And what I'm happy to see, for example, like we have the Racial Justice Coalition here, and I'm very happy to see so many of them participating in that and being involved in getting the ban on the chokehold. And when I went to the Democratic Convention, we had, I'm on the platform committee, and I was the only Black person on the platform committee in criminal justice.
Right.
And I had to fight and argue to try to get, you know, the language that I needed to get in there. And that's the kind, those are the kinds, and these are people who will tell you they're progressive that's on there.
Mm-hmm.
Right.
But they're not necessarily in line with the way that the Black community sees things.
Mm-hmm.
And then, you know, and then the other thing I want to talk about is, they're just little things like thinking that a Black person is the exception. You know, that person is articulate. They're somehow special. That in itself is a backhanded compliment. there are Black people that are doctors and lawyers and teachers and, you know, college professors. There is a whole world of very educated, very smart, you know, well-read Black people out there. This fixation on the criminals, I think, is a disservice to the Black community. I think that, yes, we have to get criminal justice reform in this country, but we also need to understand that there's a number of Black people who do all the work and don't get the jobs, don't get the promotions, don't get to get tenure at the university, don't get to be the CEO. There are other fights besides criminal justice that have to do with people of color. And also stop stereotyping us. You know, mm-hmm. we get all the black questions are about crime. No, let's talk about education. Let's talk about home ownership. Let's talk about redlining. Let's talk about, like, you know, the discrimination that we feel when we walk into a store. Nobody knows if you have a degree or not, or nobody knows who your father is. They just see you and you're Black. They don't know if you're from the Caribbean, from Africa, from Canada, you're Black, and they start following you around in a store. That's something we need to talk about.
So in addition, so you're a writer and journalist, and then also a media consultant. I just wanted to ask you a few questions about how the media, in your view, is doing right now in covering some of these issues.
Well, the media is terrible. And I think that, like I mentioned to you before this, we can see a difference since the murder of George Floyd, because like the Edmund Pettus Bridge, where we were a moral witness, as Barack Obama says, to those people, you know, John Lewis getting his head cracked out. People saw that, were horrified, and then we got the Voting Rights Act. The death of George Floyd, also, people were witness and they saw somebody taking a Black man's life away from him that way. So I think that it has also changed, because people in the newsroom are Black. People that they know are Black, and now it's starting to connect with them, the humanity being taken away. So even the journalist as a human being is affected by this, and the stories that they're turning around. And then I also see, and you can see, I mean, even look at what's going on in professional sports. It's the same thing. Suddenly the owners are like, oh my gosh, we should have listened to Kaepernick. Oh, right. you know, and that's what's happening in the media. But overall, the way that they cover, you know, Black people, particularly, you know, in politics, is very different. They look at them with a different lens. If a white person, if their campaign isn't doing so good, they'll rationalize it. A Black person's campaign is having a blaring headline, they'll put the final nail in that coffin for them. And they never give you a chance. They always have a stricter, and this mm-hmm. is the same. I mean, it's a combination of, sexism and racism. And we have a term for the two together, which we call it misogynoir. You know, when you are Black and a woman, you get it double. And so I do see the media, I do see some more coverage and attention, but is it going to last? Is it just the flavor of the month? Or are they going to go right back to what they've always done? And I see the people that they hire to be on those shows. They have people who sit up there night after night and rationalize some of the most horrible behavior that's going on in this country.
I wonder with the so now we have Trump's made pretty clear, like in the RNC, that his strategy is going to be to use racism to draw white suburban voters back to him. And I'm curious, one of the things I've noticed listening to the various, you know, cable shows, et cetera, is they don't ever lay this out as a strategy. It's sort of, they take what he's saying kind of at face value. And I wonder if you notice that, if you think the media could do a better job of saying, wait a second, that racism is a strategy that Republicans use to attract the white voters.
I think they do that. They do it every day. I mean, this morning that, you know, the headlines are basically saying, you know, that he said it's not true about when he said that the military people that had died were losers. And so Well, right. That's not the headline. You know, that should not be the headline. But as far as the media, first of all, let's talk about, you know, protest, you know, versus looting. So, you know, to lump the whole thing, because understand that they're looking for ratings and clicks and page views. So sure. If they show like a bonfire, and, you know, that's more exciting and that's going to get more eyeballs than if they show people being orderly and you know, with their signs. So they make it about the people that burned up something. They make it about the loudest, the most disruptive, and then also the words they use, because this group of white people with guns that are, you know, harming people are patriots. They're militia. These people over here are thugs and gangs. So, you know, the language that's used is tells you right there, and what they focus on. And then also the pictures that they show, because they tend to, if there's one black person in a rowdy crowd, they're going to show the picture in the paper of the black person. So it's not that way, you know, when it comes to those, for example, with the KKK or, you know, white nationalists, all these years, the media has had the opportunity to call them terrorists, to make it plain that these people were a threat, and they have not done that. But, you know, but if something happens at a peaceful protest, they'll hone in on that. And then it paints, you know, the whole thing that did Black Lives Matter somehow gets blamed. Black Lives Matter is a decentralized organization. There's no president, vice president. There's no meetings that everybody knows about with Black Lives Matter. Anybody can jump up and say, I'm Black Lives Matter. And that's why with what's going on with the disinformation campaigns that the Russians have done, they put a picture of a black person up there and they will start something and claim their Black Lives Matter, and they will purposely cause dissent. And then people believe it. People believe it.
Yeah. You touched on this a few minutes ago, but I mean, what are the stories you would most like to see that are not being reported right now in sort of the mainstream media, for lack of a better term?
Okay. Well, let's talk. We'll talk about COVID. Okay. The fact that black people are dying at a disproportionate rate in this country. Yes. That brown people are dying at a disproportionate rate. That the reason underneath that is because of the health disparities. Number one, what's causing health disparities? Well, lack of access to health care, poverty, stress, racism. These are underlying factors that cause people to be unhealthy. Trauma. Childhood trauma, these little kids seeing their, like, your father being shot in the back 7 times, these little kids will grow up and have diseases later in life because of that childhood trauma. These are the things they're not talking about. Why is it more are sick? Then the next thing comes to opportunity for jobs. Why is it they don't have the opportunity to go to school? Because they don't have, that you can't afford. Tuition is so high, the books are high. Then let's talk about what type of education do you get in public school. I can tell you one time I went to live in Philadelphia and I went to a black school for a short period of time. I had grown up in a white neighborhood in Los Angeles. I went to a black school in Philadelphia. The teachers came in and sat cross-legged on top of the desk and didn't teach anything the whole day. I never had seen anything like that in my life. The teachers were disrespectful. They didn't really teach us. The books were not new. The classrooms were not new. I transferred back into a white, you know, school that was, you know, college preparatory type school. But the people that are trapped in poverty don't have that option. They're not going, they don't get to go to a private school. Their parents are working 2 jobs. They're not coming down to see that this teacher is abusive or that this teacher got sent to the black school because they're a terrible teacher. So they have bad teachers. They have old textbooks. They don't have the technology. They can't afford it. So you're starting off with all of these things that are putting them behind. That's really the story. So COVID is really the symptom. The high mortality rate is the symptom of all of these other things that have led to people being unhealthy in our society.
And to what extent is the, you also touched on this a little bit, but I mean, are newsrooms, in your view, diversifying? Are they succeeding in, are there more Black journalists now than when you were first starting out?
No, for example? There's less. Well, first of all, you have to understand that the media has lost probably 2/3 sure. people in journal. I don't know the number, but it's very high, the sure. number of people that they've had to cut. You know, a lot of reasons. I mean, you know, a lot of it, you know, has to do with the way that the internet has affected, you know, people.
Sure.
But the other thing, too, is that, you know, there's nepotism. And so you have to, a lot of those jobs, you have to know somebody, be recommended. So you have to get in the pipeline. So I started Women of Color War in order to give, you know, young women of color an opportunity to meet the elected officials here in San Diego. So at once a year, we have this event and all the high schools get to, you know, we get to send students. They get to meet their elected officials. They have an opportunity to get internships, mentorships. And it's through that that you get to work in the office, get to know them and have an opportunity to get a job. Mm-hmm. And it's the same thing in all the different professions. In the entertainment business, rich kids' parents can send them to Hollywood to do an internship for free.
Right.
And you can work in a studio. I mean, Barack Obama's, you know, daughter worked, you know, at a production company, but they can afford to do that. If you're poor and you say, you know, I really would like to be in show business, I want to be a movie producer. Well, your parents can't afford to send you for the summer to Hollywood and pay for your apartment and you work for free. And that goes for politics and everything else. So in the newsroom, I will say, like here in San Diego, the Union Tribune has a program that they're doing right now with the Black Journalists Association and the Hispanic journalists, where they are training, you know, up and coming young journalists of color. They had a program before that, of course, anybody could apply to. But then if you don't know about it, how do you know about it unless you know someone? So if you, it all comes down to, like, information is a valuable commodity. And the reason I started Women of Color World Media is to be able to get out information to our community in an unfiltered way so that people know more. So we share about internships and about jobs and about what's going on and give people that. And if people need an introduction, that you can have somebody that you can call on who can make that phone call for you or send that email introduction for you. That's what's really important.
Mm-hmm. Sure.
What do you think about the current media coverage of Kamala Harris now that she's on a ticket with a white man? Do you believe that the media is more favorable to Kamala Harris now than they were when she was running as a presidential candidate a year and a half ago?
Absolutely. It's so funny. I just read one today. And it, all the things that they said about her, I'm like, well, how come you didn't say this about her when she was running for president? They talked about the programs that she, you know, she did for first time offenders and how it was, you know, and they talked about how, you know, how she, you know, all the novel things she introduced when she was a DA, had all these things were in this article that they didn't talk about before they wanted to focus on things that, first of all, weren't even true. They would take something that somebody said in an article who had an agenda against her, and they would all quote it. That is such poor, terrible journalism. Mm. And yeah. That's why, you know, the K Hive, which is Kamala's own group of supporters that we have. And basically, we are just like, we would come with it, with the receipts, with the information, with the facts. When people wrote negative things about her that were not true, we would be able to show them the facts. And I'll be able to show you, like, no, this isn't true, or that's what happened. You know, I'll tell you something about, you know, a Black person being a prosecutor is very, very difficult. Because, again, you know, we had a big shift, you know, back in the 90s or back when you had a situation where you had the crack epidemic and you had a high amount of crime in the Black community, and the Black churches and Black people wanted that help with stop that crime that was going on in their communities. that's what was what started the crime bill, was Black people wanting help. And I can tell you, my aunt at the time was in her 70s. Somebody, you know, knocked her down and took her purse. And, you know, and so back then, that was the mindset. It said, oh, we need to have safety in our communities. Now, mm-hmm. the whole thing obviously got turned around and turned into a way to you know, have mass incarceration and you know, a new form of slavery. It all got turned into something. A lot of the programs that were supposed to have been in that bill got taken out. But the Congressional Black Caucus was behind the bill. And like I said, you know, Black people in Black community. So coming out of that point where now we've come to the point where it's like, if you put anybody Black in jail, you're a bad person. Mm-hmm. No, rapists, killers, you know, predators, you know, people do human trafficking. There's a lot of people who steal from you, try to, you know, in your community. Those people need to go to prison and somebody needs to prosecute them. And so that whole conversation was problematic. Mm-hmm. And no one understood that it wasn't a simple answer. Kamala can't, if you say, well, how come you didn't do this? She can't in a soundbite answer that, because usually there's jurisdiction, there's evidence, looking at it as, are we going to be able to win this case? We have 600 cases. Which ones are we going to prosecute? She was over the entire state of California as attorney general. There are 58 counties, 5,000 people working in that Department of Justice. She was not going around arresting people. She was not in those courtrooms. There were so many other people involved in so many cases. So you have to understand, she was treated in a way that other prosecutors are not. Right. Nobody's asking Adam Schiff to show his, what did he do? Mm-hmm. And it wasn't until the very end that they got on Amy, you know, Amy Klobuchar. Mm-hmm. She's same thing. She was attorney general, but Kamala, they wanted to drag her for every case that happened in the state of California. Every arrest in the state of California was her fault. And so that's the kind of thing I do feel that now they're suddenly going like, oh my gosh, she's really great. And remember how she took on Kavanaugh and Barr and this. All of a sudden they're like seeing, but she always was a superstar.
Right.
Always was. And so it's about reporting. It's not that she's perfect, has a perfect record, but it's about the balance and skewing it against her, which is what they did. And as far as the white man being on the ticket, you know, Joe Biden, I have changed my, and I'm, you know, I tell people it's okay. When you have new information, you can change your mind. And I've changed my mind. You know, I now feel Joe Biden is the right person for this time. Mm-hmm. And the reason is because the country needs somebody like Joe Biden, who is such the antithesis to Trump. And so Joe Biden is like the anti-Trump. And so, you know, he is a kind, good person, and you can see the difference in somebody who has empathy. Yes, there are things about him in his past and judgment and decisions that he made, but look at who he is today. Mm-hmm. He's put a Black woman on his ticket, and he has committed to doing so many things for our community. So I say, I've changed my opinion and I feel that he is the right choice at this time. And the fact that Kamala is on the ticket makes it a stronger ticket.
All right.
Well, thank you.
Yeah. One of the observations today, and I think it's a common theme from start to finish, is that our lenses are biased. They just are. And for those of us who are not Black, our lenses are biased in ways that are incredibly harmful and inherently racist. And at the core of all of this is lack of racial diversity. So, of course, we focused a lot in this conversation about lack of that diversity in a newsroom. We have in previous episodes talked about the challenge of lack of diversity in companies and in boardrooms, corporate boardrooms. Today, we've even touched on the harm in lack of diversity in progressive circles. And I know that for many folks who might be listening right now who are white, they're looking around them and they're saying, wow, my company is really white. The newsrooms for the papers that I read are very white. The people that I go to protests with are white. And in fact, my social circle is predominantly white. What kinds of advice, practical advice, do you have for folks who recognize this shocking lack of diversity and want to do something about it. Because I'm sure if for anybody to think, I'm just going to walk up to the next Black person I see and say, hey, will you be my friend? That's not a thing, right?
Oh, no, that is a thing.
It is a thing. Talk to us about that.
No, I have somebody actually sent me a text and asked me to be their Black friend, which I thought was hilarious.
What did you say?
I don't know.
Angela's friendly. She might have said yes.
I did. I did say yes. But the idea that they, you know, they don't know anybody that's Black. And I, like I said, there's only so much of me to go around in San Diego.
Yes.
So that's what's, it's tough here because everybody does want me to be their Black friend. And so, but I want to say something about, you know, okay, first of all, expanding, you know, your circle. Mm-hmm. First of all, you know, so you can go to a Black church. You really can.
Yeah.
And you know, people are very nice and very friendly. You can go to an NAACP meeting, an Urban League meeting, or the Black Chamber. You can go mm-hmm. and meet some Black people. It's mm-hmm. okay. We go. See, the thing is, I grew up being in white spaces my whole life.
Right.
But white people haven't been in Black spaces. It's like they're a nervous wreck if they have to be, if there's too many Black people around.
Right.
But go to, it's all right. You can go to the Caribbean picnic and, you know, bring your basket and sit out with the Caribbean Black people. Yeah. So, I mean, you can make it the same way I go, mm-hmm. you can go. Mm-hmm. And the other thing is reading. It's like read some Black publications. Everything's online now. Mm-hmm. You know, read Ebony and Jet and The Griot and The Root and you know, there's lots of, you know, Black, you know, women's, you know, websites.
Yeah.
You know, I have, you know, mine is womanofcolorroar.com. You can come up there and read what, you know, the things that I post, but diversify your thought process.
Yes.
And I think one of the things that Trump is using, this idea of fear of, you know, that, you know, oh my gosh, Black people are going to move into your neighborhood and, you know, Black people are going to, you know, bring down your property values and your schools won't be good and this kind of thing. It's that you have to understand that Black people are a very diverse group. Mm-hmm. So you're not, there's, you know, they're going to be Black people who are going to be on every economic strata. Mm-hmm. And so, and you can seek out people that, you know, have something in common with you, whether if you like boats or you in a running right. club, there's right. different Black people doing a variety of things. Yeah. But this idea of stoking that racial fear, like this, you know, like the Willie Horton thing that, you know, oh, you know, Black people are bad. And I think getting to know more Black people, mm-hmm. not just you go and you volunteer down at the soup kitchen and help some poor Black people. No, why don't you like go meet some you know, some Black people that in a book club, Black mm-hmm. book club, mm-hmm. meet some different types of Black people that and have conversations and start to build some relationships with Black people. And that's going to open up and I think so much to your point of view and your world.
Right. Well, I think this is, I'm sorry, go ahead, Lucas.
Well, I was just going to say, I know we're running out of time, but one of the things that we've kind of touched on a lot in the last few weeks is, the individual, you know, actions we can take mm-hmm. and then the systemic problems that have gotten us to where we are in the first place. And I'm curious, particularly with working with some of these progressive activists who were very pro-war and not seeing Harris as the candidate you were, for example, if you see any disconnect with them in terms of how they approach those systemic issues. So just as an example, one thing we've talked about is people who have like a Black Lives Matter yard sign in their yard, but then they also have another yard sign opposing affordable housing, or they don't want, you know, an integrated school system or whatever. And I'm just curious if you're, because we I think the natural thing for us to do is talk about, you know, the individual things each of us can do, which is obviously so important, but I don't know. I feel like the systemic issues sometimes get obscured.
Well, what's important, it has to do with, not just, okay, being an ally, meaning that, you know, and it's the same thing being to not just, you know, not be a racist, to be an anti-racist. It's the same thing, I think, is that to take an active role in, you know, almost in sponsoring, you know, a yeah. Black person. So if there's an opening in your job, then, you know, that's why you need to go and to the Black, you know, check out some more Black organizations, you know, the sororities, the fraternities, but you can let them know that there's an opening at your job, and or you can help that process along. You can introduce people in. You can go like to, you know, to the high school. You can mentor some young Black kids. You can help them fill out their college applications. I mean, there are things that you can do to help the process. But as far as the balance of power goes, you know, institutional power, when it comes to, it has to do, it starts off with having access. So if you are white and you're in that boardroom and there's no Black people, you can suggest that, you know, let's reach out to the community and diversify this board. So I think it's up to white people in those white spaces to, if you really are supposed to be an ally, or now they're saying we need co-conspirators, you need to make your job is to help integrate that company you work for.
That's
your
right.
job is to go down to that city council meeting and or to join the redistricting committee. Right now we're going to have redistricting in San Diego. Get on that committee of how they draw the boundaries. So you need to get on there and you need to make sure that we get affordable housing, and also that there's enough, there's so much money. But even with the grant programs, if you get on one of those grant boards to give out money to organizations, Black organizations get a tiny little bit of the grant money and these other organizations get all the money. And then they'll say, okay, well, we'll give a little bit in the Black community. No, we should have that money to Black organizations. And if you were on that board that gave out that money, then you could be the person that voted to give it to the Black organization.
So I'm hearing you say change the systems through individual actions.
Yes. And take a responsibility. Don't report back. Don't just report back that there's no, oh, you work with all white people. No, change, do something about it.
Thank you.
Sure.
Thank you. Angela, you are an energetic and engaging guest. You've been so wonderful today. Thank you so much for taking time to chat with us.
Thank you.
Well, thank you so much for having me. And I look forward to many more episodes.
All right. Lots to talk about there, Antoinette. I do want to thank Angela, not only for speaking with us, but also, I mentioned this last week, this was the guest for whom I realized that the only quiet place in Utah was the bathroom. So mm-hmm. thank you for indulging me as I sat outside the shower.
It was a beautiful bathroom, though. I'm going to give you that. It was picturesque.
Lovely bathroom.
Very
lovely
good
bathroom.
Backdrop. Nice tile work.
Yes. Well maintained bathroom. okay, so it's been, you know, about a week, I think, since we talked to Angela. What has kind of stuck with you? What you said beforehand, you had things to add, to say, to reflect on.
Yeah. In the moment, anytime that we do these types of interviews or do recording, I'm kind of more focused on being in the present and not always letting what's actually being said settle in. So it was on a re-listen that I really started to connect some dots for myself. And one of them was at the very beginning of the interview where Angela shared that with her fellow activists in San Diego who are white, that their choice of candidates among all of those 20 plus candidates that we had at one point on the Democratic side led to a bit of a break. And she used a couple of terms in there. Like she said, she felt like there was a bit of white savior complex in those white activists' choice of candidate. She talked about, and this was one of the quotes that I had written down on re-listen, "I'm not racist because I donate to NAACP. Without really understanding why their lack of support for a candidate who was a woman of color, a Black woman like Kamala Harris, might be revealing some inner biases that they really didn't want to cop to.
Yep.
And so I wanted to just say that kind of in summary, just going back and kind of trying to pick up my thoughts again, there was an activist, and I don't have her permission to share her name, but you and I both know her and have organized with her, Lucas. Mm-hmm. She had said that whoever the Black women in the United States support is the candidate that she will throw her support behind. And I always thought from the get-go that was an incredibly smart and valuable way to go. Yeah. And I think because of that, because of her saying that, I had at the beginning donated to almost everybody's campaign equally. I didn't choose a favorite, although I had some that I thought I was really leaning toward, but I didn't like jump in and yeah. campaign during primary season for any of the candidates up until the last couple of weeks. I had stuff from multiple candidates' campaigns, tote bags and t-shirts and whatnot. So yeah, anyway, that one stuck out with me. What about for you?
Yeah, I mean, I keep coming back to the same thing, and I feel like, I think we basically agree, but this, I mean, I was struck at the end of the conversation as we were talking about the systemic and the individual. Mm-hmm. I keep coming back to this issue because it seems like, I think that keeping the emphasis on how each of us individually can reflect, change attitudes, change actions, mm-hmm. etc., mm-hmm. is obviously key to everything. Mm-hmm. But I am stuck on, I don't think that necessarily addresses the systemic issues.
It doesn't.
Still.
It doesn't.
And how
I'm
do
not
we
sure
do,
if
how
it
do
needs
we do,
to.
It doesn't need to, but I feel like there's still not as much conversation about some of the systemic stuff. And it was interesting sort of hearing her reflect on that.
I think it's interesting that you think that, because I believe that one of the reasons why we picked this book and why we're focusing for 4 weeks with this book being like the central
yeah.
piece of it or jumping off point is because most white activists focus on the systemic stuff, the policy stuff, the legislative stuff. It's all things that are more theoretical and a little bit more like, you can talk about the things that society is doing wrong without having to talk about the things that you are personally doing wrong or could be doing better.
Yes.
And so I feel like it makes a lot of sense to me that our discussions do keep coming back to actions that we need to take on the individual level, reflections that we need to be having.
Yes.
Learning to personally sit in discomfort with ourselves
yes.
and know
yes,
that
yes.
we have room to improve.
I agree. I think the only quibble I'd have with that, and this is separate from our conversation with Angela, mm-hmm. Is I am not sure that in the progressive activist spaces I've been in, the key systemic issues, what I would consider the key systemic issues, are mm-hmm. that frequently addressed. Like housing, like integrated education. I mean,
She talked about that too, didn't she?
Yeah. I mean, these are areas where it seems to me there's some hypocrisy in sort of white progressive activist spaces. It's like, well, you know, I mean, just to give you an example, I'll just give you an example. And again, this is like not a great example because I used to teach in private school. And as we know, private school basically came out of white people wanting to stay segregated. So I'm giving an example, but it's going in with that caveat. But this is the example that I would give. I taught at a private school where I think the vast majority of parents would consider themselves very progressive. Mm-hmm. There was always frequent talk of unpacking the invisible knapsack, white privilege, et cetera, et cetera. The school I taught at, there were 16 kids in each class. Mm-hmm. There was not room for more than 16 kids in each class. That's another thing about private school. You're paying for the small class sizes. Mm-hmm. So my question to those, I mean, I never asked this of these parents or of the, I mean, I'm asking you now. I'm mm-hmm. not saying I asked this at the time, though I probably should have, is would any of those white parents give up their slot of those 16 slots mm-hmm. for a student of color in the name of diversity? Well, probably not, right? So yes. I guess my issue, and again, this is really separate from the conversation we had with Angela, though, it made me think about this.
I don't think it is separate. Well, I think it's not, this is okay.
Then it's at the heart of it. oh my God, I'm so easily swayed. I guess my fear about all of the individual talk is that it could lapse into kind of like self-care talk, if that makes sense, as a way of actually not addressing those systemic issues that we are all.
I understand what that means. What do you mean by self-care talk?
But I mean the kind of like, oh, we need to. There's an element to all of the working on ourselves chatter that feels to me slightly like it's veering into kind of faux self-care. As opposed to talking about maybe self-care might not be this might not be the best analogy, but what I'm saying is you're saying, right, we don't want to focus so much on the systemic talk that it lets us off the hook as individuals. And what I'm saying is I wouldn't want the kind of individual action talk that we all need to take, the individual actions we all need to take talk to distract or be instead of focusing on what each of us individually need to do to address the systemic issues. This could just be
I guess all I'm saying is I don't know that we have to make a choice between one or the other. I think the whole point is that since June, since so many of us have found ourselves washed up in this violent storm on the shores of Woke Island, that we need to acknowledge that the donation to the NAACP and the things that we have done to address systemic changes alone is not enough.
Absolutely.
We need to do that and do more of it. And we need to address these issues closer to home.
Yes.
One of the funniest things that I, the end of the interview where Angela says that somebody did come up to her and say, "Will you be my black friend?" Do you remember that?
Oh, I remember that. Yes.
I remember
that.
What I enjoyed about her response to that is that she understood the need. She didn't feel offended by the question, the request, the invitation, and that she understands this person is doing some of that individual work, maybe in a way that's not particularly graceful, but they're doing the work, and she honors that. And I really appreciated that about her.
I mean, I appreciated that, too. It seemed above and beyond to me,
yes.
for sure. Please do not do that, fellow white listeners. That's extremely weird. I know we've been doing this for a long time and have gotten to know each other really well, Antoinette, because we're at the point in our relationship where we like semi-argue about things we actually agree about, which I always think that's very familial. Kind of thing, like, wait, are we actually disagreeing here?
I love that.
Not really, but okay. It's fantastic, and we will put up in our show notes all the links to Angela's work and her projects, which are all worth checking out, her podcast, etc.
She's so great. Some of that same energy and experience and wisdom that you heard during the interview, you'll be able to get from some of those other resources and content that she creates.
She was also my best experience ever with the city of San Diego, because she's from San Diego, right?
Yes.
Yes. And my only other experience there was when I was a kid. We went to visit my aunt and uncle who lived in maybe LA. For some reason, we ended up in San Diego during the Republican National Convention of 1996.
No joke. Wow.
And so I've always thought of it as a very conservative place. So it was nice to get a different perspective on San Diego.
Yes. You know, San Diego's beautiful, and I would recommend you go back there on a direct flight the next time that you are ready to travel. It's beautiful. It is really lovely and beautiful.
Well, I'm going to send my letter to Delta first.
Yes, do that. Be a good consumer. I wanted to mention, kind of in closing this episode at least, that for me, the discussions we've been having have been very useful. And One question mark that continues to like pop up in my head, over my head, like a cartoon, is a question that you had posed in the first episode, which was, how do I connect with any of these issues as someone who is neither black nor white? And the question of identity.
Just to be clear, I asked that of you.
Yes.
I asked that of you.
Yes. That is one that I feel like, yes, you asked it of me. Who else would you have been asking it of?
Well, no, the way I was hearing the question, I was suddenly thinking, wait, am I not white or black?
I was saying that a question that you asked me in that first episode of this arc, episode one, had to do with my own, how I identify, because I am neither black nor white.
Right.
And in what cases do I feel like Robin DiAngelo is writing in the book as though she's talking to me, like I'm white adjacent, I'm practically white, versus times where I may feel like she's discussing inequities and oppressions that I may feel because I am not white. Pretty fascinating stuff.
Really? Yeah. My God.
My brain is going 100 miles an hour on this.
You've been thinking about it?
Been thinking about it. And we've got another episode coming up where we are going to hear maybe some feedback on the Rage Line, and we will just have some closing thoughts on the book and just sort of wrap up this four-episode arc on white fragility.
Yes, this is your last week to dial into the Rage Line and to vent to us. Can I give people just one call to action that's completely separate from all of this? Mm-hmm. I meant to do this at the beginning, but I said last week that I had experimented finally with REACH, which
relational
is
the
relational organizing tool that Matt Oliver last season came and talked to us about. And if you are volunteering for a campaign or want to volunteer for a campaign and they are using this software, I recommend it because I finally played around with it and it is cool.
Yay.
It is creepy. I think it's a little bit creepy because it goes into your phone and tells you who is in your congressional district.
Right.
But given, once you get past the creepy factor, there were all sorts of people because our congressional district is so gerrymandered. I have a friend in Blanco.
Mm-hmm.
Blanco. Mm-hmm. How do we say Blanco?
In Texas and you're a white person, you say Blanco.
We now say Blanco. I texted her. I said to this person, I said she has sort of a common name, and I said, but an uncommon middle name. And I said, is this your middle name? And she said, how did you know that? And let me tell you about Reach.
Yeah.
So it's a little bit creepy, but I think it's really incredible software, and so that's a volunteer opportunity depending on if you're working with the campaign.
I'm going to second that. And for those of you who just shudder at the thought of cold calling on a phone bank, random people, dialing people you don't know, relational organizing is your choice. That's the thing.
And what I was not understanding about relational organizing that Matt helped me understand, and then I really understood after Reach, is just the number by virtue of, you know, I've lived in Austin for 15 years. Mm-hmm. The number of people who, a lot of these people I wouldn't say I'm friends with or even know especially well, but it's someone who I'd be more comfortable saying, hey, are you supporting this candidate? Can I get you to volunteer? Than just calling a complete stranger. So it is beyond just kind of glancing at Facebook and saying, oh, this other person lives here. I mean, there were people who I worked with 10 years ago who, frankly, I didn't even know were in my phone. Right, and it's like, oh, they're actually in the same congressional district. It would not be that awkward for me to send that email and just say, hey, I'm, you know, volunteering so-and-so, blah, blah, blah. A lot of blah, blah, blah today. Blah, blah, blah is the new woo.
Season two's woo is blah, blah, blah. There is a lawnmower piping up outside. So I think that's our cue to kind of wrap this up. I want to say thank you to our patrons. We will do a full shout out in the fourth episode by name. For now, thank you, patrons. If you want to add on and help to support this podcast beyond listening, you can do so at patreon.com/owthisworld. How else can they reach us if they want to just talk with us casually, Lucas?
Okay, this is also the last week to call the Rage Line to tell us what you thought about this set of episodes, about the book White Fragility by Robin DiAngelo. If you have questions, if you have thoughts on either of the issues raised by our fantastic interview guests, Alexander Montalvo and Angela DeJoseph, the number is 702-907-RAGE. That is 702-907-RAGE. For those of you who want to know what the number is without the word, it is 702-907-7243. And we will play some of those responses on the air next week. And then the Rage Line will stay open all season, but we're just moving on to the next.
We're moving on to the next topic after this week. You can also drop us an email, which sometimes folks do. We love to hear from you. othisworldpod@gmail.com. We're also on Twitter and Instagram, and our handle is @othisworldpod. You know, subscribe, please, if you haven't. I think many of you have. Share the podcast with people you know. If you're on Apple Podcasts in particular, just clicking that little 5-star button, it's going to help. It's going to help people find us that don't know that we exist. It'll help people that you don't know find us. So we would really appreciate that. And next week, we will have our final episode in this 4-episode arc on White Fragility by Robin DiAngelo Lucas. It was great seeing you back in your home space again.
Yes. Welcome back to my off-white yellow room.
Butter yellow, just like mine.
My butter yellow. Thank you. All right. See you next week.
See ya. Bye.